One game kills time, the other kills people. Luckily, our game only kills diets, really. It's another sweet and salty episode of Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Rejects' weekly cult exploitation film podcast that seeks to set before you a feast of overlooked and or underrated gems. Served up with no irony, not even on the side. This is Brian Salisbury, former writer of the JFC column on FSR, and joining me, as always, is my friend and co-pilot, the Dallas to my ace, screenwriter, novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Why do you get to be ace?
Because I said so.
I look closer to ace than you do.
Oh, is this really going to happen?
I have the costume, for fuck's sake.
No, and I'm glad you admitted to that. You know, the first step is admitting it.
I have a Megaforce costume. I have worn it to cons before. It exists.
Yeah, and now we have no reason to doubt that, and I'm so happy.
None whatsoever.
I want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is on iTunes. If you just search for Junk Food Cinema in their podcast section, while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? We're also available on Stitcher and on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Kind of a somber note we're starting on this week because the film world has lost an icon recently. And though the passing of Mickey Rooney is indeed a sad goodbye to a living link in our cinematic past, I'm actually referring to the death of screenwriter Everett DeRoche. I don't really enjoy doing retrospectives after a person has died because I'm not fond of turning fandom into a eulogy. But I think Mr. DeRoche deserves immeasurably more reverence and, frankly, eulogizing than he will likely receive.
You know, the thing is it's interesting. This was a harsh reminder of one of the things that I've learned not only as a critic, but as a screenwriter and a novelist, is that as a novelist, if you write one good book that does really well, you can be recognized for that for a long time. Mm-hmm. If you write a particularly great book, you look like someone like Salinger. He lived his entire life famous for that one book, even though he refused to be published again. You write one good movie, nobody knows who you are. You write 5 good movies, there's also a good chance very few people out of the industry knows who you are.
Right.
And people, even the hardcore fans, the people who love your movies, may not have drawn all the dots of all your films together. And this is one of those guys. This is one of those guys who wrote 5 of the best known Ozploitation flicks of the Ozploitation era. He is ostensibly the reigning king of Ozploitation. You know, that usually goes to Brian Trenchard Smith, to the Mad Max movies. But those are more the A-listers of Ozploitation. DeRoche wrote 5 films that are known by the film lovers, you know, and the fans of Ozploitation as being some of the most important Ozploitation films. And that's what we get to talk about tonight, is 5 really great films that might ordinarily just come up in an Ozploitation episode, but they're all written by the same guy, a really inventive, really genius, you know, young writer at the time who was turning out just really inventive stuff that some of which was way ahead of its time, some of which didn't totally 100% work, but was always interesting.
Yeah, and that's part of what we've always wanted to do with this show, is kind of be able to share with you guys great films that for one reason or another may have flown under your radar. And frankly, you know, when I say that he deserves more attention than he's gotten, that's not a knock on those of you listening who haven't heard his name before. In fact, that's entirely understandable. I mean, most of the films he's written have had limited or, in fact, no home release in the United States. But if you have been lucky enough to see the documentary Not Quite Hollywood, The Wild Untold Story of Ozploitation by Mark Hartley, the best movies featured in that documentary, and as Cargill said, if we were going to do just our favorite Ozploitation movies, with maybe one or two exceptions, they were all written by Everett DeRoche. You know, to kind of give you a quick summary of what we mean when we say Ozploitation, there was this period of time from about the late 60s to the late 80s where the genre film industry in Australia was booming. And there were two reasons for that, one of which being a very relaxed censorship movement, very much just sort of like, here's the R certificate and just do whatever you need to because now we can basically self-regulate. So that helped a lot, and that opened up a lot of creative – that struck down a lot of creative boundaries. The other thing being that these movies, by and large, were made not for Australian audiences. They were made to be shipped over to the States and, you know, and basically make money off the American box office.
What they would do is they would take – they would hire American and British actors, people that Americans recognized. They would that most of the time they would strip out the Australian-ness of the movie.
Yeah.
They would pretend that they were set in the United States or set in some generic place.
Right.
Which becomes weird at certain times when you start paying attention and you're like, wait, where is Harlequin set? I don't quite know. Where is this supposed to be? It's like a magical fantasy land to a certain extent. But what you'd end up with are these films that Americans would be tricked into thinking were American films, and then they would see these really good Aussie films most of the time.
Yeah.
They weren't all good, but you know, there were a lot of really good ones. And some of them turned out to be, you know, genre masterpieces. You know, things like Mad Max and The Road Warrior were Ozploitation classics. As mentioned before, Brian Trenchard Smith, some of his films that snuck over here, like BMX Bandits and
Escape 2000.
Escape 2000, aka Turkey Shoot.
Yep.
Came over here and were saw and were appreciated by folks. But these, what we're talking about tonight, these five DeRoche films, they are all very much, the essence of what they were trying to do with Ozploitation. And they're all weird and they're all cool and they're all very different from the norm. And they were all things that none of them ever hit big, but watched in together, really paint a picture of a very cool time in cinema.
And most of these films that DeRoche wrote were also these interesting sort of junctions between art and commerce. I mean, you have these films that are very, very marketable and have these genre elements, but a lot of them we're going to talk about were also just really brilliantly constructed and are admirable from any through any lens, through any technical lens you want to lend to it. And I see no reason to stand on any more ceremony and just jump right in. The first film I want to talk about, which is by far my favorite film on the list, my favorite film of DeRoche's, is Road Games.
Road Games. If someone doesn't stop soon, there won't be anyone left alive to play.
And Road Games was directed by Richard Franklin, who kind of became known in the era as Australia's Alfred Hitchcock, which I know that that's sort of a dubious title that a lot of people, if they're making thrillers, you know, immediately the name that comes up is Hitchcock. But you have to remember with Richard Franklin, he was actually a disciple of Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, he had worked with the guy. He very much admired him. And almost every film that Richard Franklin made was in some way a tribute to Hitchcock. I would actually call Richard Franklin the Australian Brian De Palma. Because he's been
I think that's the closer analogy.
Yeah, because they're not exactly like Hitchcock films, but they're enough like Hitchcock films that you can notice from a mile away the reverence that he has for Hitchcock, and therefore it's more like watching a Brian De Palma film. And in Road Games, he basically took the idea of Rear Window and made it kinetic. So instead of a guy who is kind of bedridden from a broken leg and confined to an apartment, it's a truck driver. And the things that he's witnessing and the murder that he becomes convinced is happening is things that he sees while he's on the road. So it's actually kind of an interesting twist on the story. Road Games is one of those movies that has a really strange and wonderful mixture of tones. I mean, at one moment, it's a freaky and like deathly tense serial killer film. And at other moments, it's playful and full of puns. It's silly. It's like a silly road movie. Like, you know, he has this thing where he keeps seeing the same people on the road again and again, like you do when you go on a long trip. Sometimes you pass the same people over and over again. And he makes, like, little jokes and stories about all the people that he sees on the road. And, of course, leading to one of my favorite jokes in the movie, which is where he sees a station wagon full of children's playground balls and just says, "No, there's a man with balls." I mean, he talks to himself because there's nobody else in the car. So
it's him and his dog.
Him and his dog. Him and his dingo. Yes, in fact. But it's such a fun movie. Just from the initial setup, it's a fun movie.
Yeah, you know, it's not my favorite of the DeRoche films, but it's the best of the DeRoche films. It's the one that you can hand to anybody and go, you're going to dig this, and know that they're going to dig it, because it's a genuinely good movie. It's a really good movie. It's one of those you find it very hard to believe that it just hasn't caught on and been passed around enough for everyone to have seen it. It was one that was passed to me years ago when it was first put out on DVD, and I was over at Harry Knowles's place, and he goes, hey, I have a hunch you've never seen Road Games. And I'm like, what's that? And he goes, just go home and watch it right now. And he put it in my hands, and I watched it like three times that week. It's just so good. You just kind of, you fall for it. It's Stacy Keach, right?
Yeah, Stacy Keach plays the truck driver.
He plays the truck driver and
the American truck driver in Australia.
Yeah. And now the thing is it's Rear Window, but I have always felt that it's very much Rear Window meets Duel. Like that's the pitch.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's how you kind of sell it as Rear Window meets Duel, and it hits both of those perfectly, but becomes its own thing. It's not like Disturbia, where in Disturbia it's clearly Rear Window with a gimmick.
Right.
It's the Rear Window story, but it's its own film that is genuinely good and creepy.
Yeah.
And every beat works and the humor works. You know, the whole bit with the dingo is fantastic. You know, There's a whole kind of storyline that leads up to some great punchlines with that. Everything in this movie just is really smart, really sharp, and just really cleverly written.
Yeah. That's the thing is the direct tribute to Everett DeRoche in this film, I think, is the dialogue. And is the way that Stacy Keach can carry the movie, whether he's by himself in the cab with the dingo or whether he's playing off of his co-star. Somehow he runs into the only other American in Australia, according to this movie, which is Jamie Lee Curtis as a hitchhiker. And the two of them kind of form this, like, almost like this Hardy Boys type mystery solving team when they both kind of latch onto the idea that this person who Stacy Keach is just calling Smith or Jones because he has to assign names to people based on things that he sees. He doesn't have any actual interaction with them. And they both become convinced that, yes, there is something going on with this guy. So they begin to sort of pursue him. And that's where things obviously get a little hairy. And I love the way it switches lanes, you know, pun obviously intended, where it does go from this sort of like campy road movie and, you know, everybody's having fun and being kind of even a little bit wistful at times.
Really? Changing gears?
Also shifting gears, changing lanes.
Your pun button.
I didn't want to use too many and flood it. I thought I would pick one or the other. But yeah, and then you get to this, you know, the cinematography around the initial kill in that movie is fucking gorgeous. I mean, you have, first of all, Grant Page plays the serial killer. Grant Page, who is one of the greatest stuntmen of all time and who turns up in a host of different exploitation films playing various characters. Of course, the infamous Stunt Rock is all about Grant Page. I mean, that is exactly what that movie is about. And Grant Page is playing this.
Don't pretend that Stunt Rock isn't also about the awesomeness that is sorcery.
Yeah, it is also about that band. That is a fact that you stated. But yeah, so Grant Page is playing the serial killer, and in the initial kill, he just kind of comes in to this dimly lit hotel room. There's a girl that he's picked up who is sitting there naked playing his guitar, and he's like got this guitar string, this extra guitar string that he's wrapped around his hands, and just the way the light is gleaming off of it, it's almost like an Italian horror film for a few moments, and it's beautiful. And that kind of thing happens over and over again throughout the course of the movie, where you have these just breathtaking shots that kind of come out of nowhere because you really think you're on board for one type of movie, and then it constantly switches back and forth.
Well, that's one of the hallmarks of Ozploitation is that, you know, you had these really hungry directors, these guys who should have been working in Hollywood, but because of the situation being what it was, they were doing what they could down in Australia. And what you end up with is these guys trying very hard to make these really amazing films. And so how they made up for their lack of budgets or their lack of other support was they would hire these great cinematographers and they would frame these really amazing shots. The cinematography is going to be mentioned in four of the five movies tonight easily, because all of these DeRoche films that we chose are really well known for just how beautiful and unique each of them look. Each one looks looks radically different from the other, which is why so few people actually put these movies together as being written by the same guy. And Road Games is the one that looks the most Hollywood of them. It's the one that looks like a slick Hollywood thriller and that you could pop in and show to your family tonight and everyone would assume that it was a Hollywood film that they'd never seen before.
And it stand, you know, like I said, like it's not a coincidence that Richard Franklin is kind of, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock comparisons or the Brian De Palma comparisons. Apparently, Richard Franklin gave Everett DeRoche a copy of the screenplay for Rear Window before they started working on this movie. And not only that, but if you pay attention, Stacey Keach doesn't call Jamie Lee Curtis by her name, which is Pamela. He calls her Hitch, which is short for Hitchhiker, but was also a nickname that Alfred Hitchcock went by. So it's a very clever movie, very, very fun. And that climax with the truck kind of like fighting its way down progressively smaller alleyways, pursuing Grant Page's character, it's just so good, just such an amazing and fun film. And what a great stinger at the end. Like something you think the movie's over, you think everything is finished, and then there's just this great little sort of final axe drop. And I really, really like this. Like I said, this is my favorite film that we're going to talk about. Really highly recommend it. But also among the Everett DeRoche canon, a film that we absolutely have to talk about, and I'm going to try and say this name with all the authenticity of a real Aussie, and that is Razorback.
Razorbacks.
He's only got two states of being. Dangerous or dead.
Razorback.
Are we going into Razorback now?
Razorback.
Yeah, Razorback is a phenomenally interesting film.
Yeah.
It is it's of the films we're talking about tonight, it's one of the least perfect. It's not, and I say that not to to be really defensive for the film, but rather because it's a really good, interesting experimental film that I think fails on one or two cylinders, which are completely understandable for the era it was made in, and as a result doesn't have the punch of several of the other films. But it's a really, really good, cool film. In fact, Brian and I refer to Piranha as the very best Jaws knockoff ever made. Razorback is the second best Jaws knockoff ever made. It's Jaws with a giant fucking razorback out in the outback.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't think of a warthog as being inherently frightening. And in most cases,
unless you've actually dealt with them.
Well, unless you've actually – that's the thing is you have to remember this about Australia. Everything in Australia is trying to kill you. When we're talking about the fauna of Australia, you can read it in a science book. It's all trying to kill you. Most of the deadliest species of animals in the planet live in or around Australia. It is kind of absurd. It's like the world just kind of shook itself to rid itself of the scariest beasts imaginable, and they all fell into Australia. And so when we talk about a warthog, we're not talking about like even, you know, American warthogs or, you know, things that you would see in the wilderness potentially on this continent. We're talking about terrifying fucking Australian warthogs. This one just happens to be the size of a goddamn Buick.
Yeah, these are the things that are closer to javelinas than they are the warthogs that you might be thinking of. And yeah, the size of a Buick is a good comparison for that. And as it's turned out, there are actually boars that size.
Oh, good.
They do actually exist, which makes
and where
movie-
do they exist?
Well, they exist in multiple places, some in the United States.
I could have sworn you were going to say Australia.
Yeah, but I'm certain they probably have them there as well. But so the movie is made less absurd by that. You know, you might be looking at it and going, oh, it's a giant pig movie. And it's like, no, this is a genuinely interestingly weird, creepy, experimental take on Jaws. That isn't just a take on Jaws. What was interesting with what DeRoche did is he decided to make what was two different revenge movies and sew them together into one revenge film. So it's the story of a guy who's essentially T.S. Quint. He's the shark hunter Quint who has had his life destroyed by this razorback and is out combing the outback trying to find this razorback to kill it. And then an animal rights activist comes to town to highlight the slaughter of kangaroos and the use of them in dog food. And she gets hassled by some bullies and gets in a really bad situation and ends up getting killed by the Razorback as a result of that confrontation. And so the husband comes out to investigate. And so now you have these two different characters that are in their own time ultimately hunting the Razorback.
So you have these two kind of converging revenge stories going on, both of these characters who have their own sort of agenda against – I mean, it's, you know, against nature, really. And what is so effective about this as a creature feature is the design of the way that the Razorback actually moves. It is fucking fast. I mean, it completely decimates anything it touches. It runs through entire houses and knocks them over. Like, it isn't just, you know, the gnashing of teeth and the eating of people. Like, it is a destructive force of nature. And just watching it blow through buildings, and I mean, you can understand why even the most seasoned hunter. I mean, again, you think a warthog. How is that much of a threat? And it's like, well, even the most seasoned hunter in the outback of Razorbacks is terrified of this thing. And they do a good job of detailing exactly why that is. In fact, they built a fully sized, fully animatronic model Razorback for the movie at a cost of about $250,000, which for this film had to be a significant portion of the budget.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
It is.
Now, it's directed by Russell Mulcahy.
Yes.
Who is an awesome filmmaker who I really love for a number of reasons, not the least of which being that I have a soft spot for The Shadow, the 1990s version with Alec Baldwin, which he also directed. He also gave us Highlander and Highlander 2, as well as Resident Evil, whatever the
Third one.
Extinction. Resident Evil Extinction. So a guy who you probably –
I love that you just kind of blew past Highlander.
No, I didn't. Highlander.
No. You mentioned it. You're like, Highlander, Highlander 2. But let's talk about The Shadow.
I have never been the biggest fan of the Highlander movies.
I love Highlander.
It's not – it doesn't hit me the way that it hits most people.
But Mulcahy's great, and this is where Mulcahy's being a young experimental director.
Very experimental.
And he's doing – the shot structure in here is really cool. There's a lot of great transitions. There's this amazing transition shot where they do a wipe, but the wipe is with a crane coming into frame and serving as the wipe that just looks really neat. The way he frames characters, the way he frames this dusty little outback town. And then, of course, there's a sequence in which one of our characters is wandering, hallucinating in the outback.
He's gone walkabout, as they say.
He's gone walkabout. And you have all these really beautiful, weird, psychedelic shots of him out in the desert that look unlike what you usually see people doing, you know, desert psychedelia looks. It's really, really cool looking. And then you get to the third act, which is just so gritty and dirty and nasty and gross and dark. And it comes from that era, the kind of post-Spielberg era of the 80s, in which things are very dark but have very bright lights coming from weird distances that you're not sure where the light's coming from. But it lights, you know, you've got the characters lit up bright as day in the dark. And it's a very cool look that we only saw for a few years in low budget films in the 80s. And this does it better than almost any other film I've ever seen it.
I think during the documentary, they compared the cinematography to something by Ridley Scott. And I think specifically, if you're talking about early Ridley Scott, like the fantasy stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely see if it wasn't directly influenced by Ridley Scott, then there's something simpatico about the way Russell Mulcahy directs a scene and the way Ridley Scott, especially in like Legend, would direct a scene.
Oh yeah, no, and it's got some evocative moments that are very much drawing from the palette of Alien, mm-hmm. and yeah, no, there's definitely very very a heavy Ridley Scott vibe in there visually.
Yeah, I mean, this film it's a creature feature. It has all of the earmarks of that. It has all of the it hits all of the right notes for that. So if that's something you're a diehard fan of, you're going to find enjoyment in that alone. And then there's also this really cerebral, dreamlike quality to it. Like, you know, like Herger was saying with the experimental cinematography, like when he goes on that walkabout and when he's experiencing things, you know, when he's, you know, under the influence of, I mean, it's not even so much the drugs, it's just under the influence of the outback, which is a pretty popular theme for a lot of exploitation movies, is people not really being prepared for what the outback will do to them. And it's brilliant to watch, like the scene where he's walking along and it looks like he's walking through wherever that place is that Jack Sparrow goes in the was it the second or
the third?
Yeah, the third.
Yeah, when he comes back from the dead.
Where is
the Terry Gilliam sequence.
Yes, exactly. It's very Gilliam. That's exactly what it is. And it's so beautiful to look at. And you don't expect this to happen in the middle of a creature feature that is borrowing heavily from Jaws, that has a lot of those really, really sort of viscerally entertaining aspects to it. And it's such a great blend of styles.
Yeah. Now we got to get to the major flaw of the movie.
Okay.
And the major flaw of the movie, I find very forgivable because I understand the era that it comes from. The movie was made in 1984. And
as was I.
84 was a weird time for cinema. It's really the line of demarcation between what everybody says they love about the 80s and then the 80s that the rest of us lived through. And what's weird about it is the early part of the 80s, you still have a lot of what was going on in the 70s going on in cinema. You've got the last gasps of that. And you've got all these really great filmmakers doing experimental things and trying to marry both art with mainstream fare. But there was a thing that happened in 82, that really 81 and 82 that really kind of changed everything. And, E.T. came out in the summer of 82. And that combined with what was going on in America with, you know, the new Reagan era, the age of the apocalypse, you know, was over with. You know, it was, we don't need to be afraid anymore. It's a brand new morning in America. Everything's great. And the nihilism of the 70s was no longer cool. And that's the famous.
They Live speech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the famous, thing that happened with critics with, E.T. is that E.T. came out one week, The Thing came out the next week, and The Thing was just lambasted. Like critics hated it and they said, scary aliens aren't the thing anymore. That's over with. We need positive stories, not these nihilistic stories. And so what you see with Razorback is a story that should be a nihilistic story. Everything about this story is nihilistic as fuck. The villains, the setting, the monster. And then we have this strong-jawed hero who is in trying to track down what happened to his wife, who keeps getting put in situations where any rational human being would take a claw hammer to the guys that did these things to him and to his wife. And then he always just has a moment where he steadies himself and then he doesn't do what he should be doing. And you see him do that throughout this film, and it makes him genuinely uninteresting while kind of frustrating the audience, because the audience keeps being offered these scenes where, you know, someone can get the revenge that we've been building up, and we never get that release. And as a result, we end up with a hero who kind of ends up leaving the revenge to the Razorback, and never, he's always kind of responsible for the things that happen to the bad guys, but never directly responsible. So we're never interested in him, and he becomes forgettable, and all these other great characters around him are what you remember about Razorback. You remember, you know, the Razorback hunter. You remember the bullies. You remember all the crazy townspeople who were harassing his wife when she came into town. But he's just kind of there. And this was very much that turning point in cinema where we lost the ability for a while to have nihilistic anti-heroes that we could identify with.
I don't know. I feel like the Razorback hunter kind of achieves that. I mean, I think he kind of represents that. And I think in a sense, him being there kind of provides for having that character. I don't know. I don't really like the American character though. So I guess I can't totally disagree with you, because he is just kind of there, and he is just kind of, I think Russell Mulcahy said in the documentary, just kind of leaping over chasms of missing dialogue. But again, Razorback as a film, as a visual experience, is unlike any other. You know, despite the things that we're talking about, it cribbing from either intentionally or accidentally, but totally intentionally. You know, despite all of that, it is still a singularly unique creature feature.
Oh yeah.
And I love the hell out of this.
Well, that's the thing that frustrates me is like many of the Durosh films we're going to talk about, it's got one missing element keeping it from being heralded as one of the classics by you know, the keepers of the flames, if you will. And I really think that with Razorback, it's the weakness of that protagonist. I really think it's interesting. It does the same thing. It came out in the same year as Nightmare on Elm Street and does the same thing that Nightmare on Elm Street does, where the first 10, 15 minutes we're spending with these other characters who are then removed from the movie, and a side character turns out to be the protagonist that we're following for the rest of the movie, as it's a big fake out. And it's done really well. But unlike Nightmare on Elm Street, we're not left with Nancy. We're not left with this character that we're really, you know, taken by. We're left with this guy who keeps being put in situations and always kind of doing the thing the audience isn't really want him to do.
Yeah. Well, I never liked Nancy, so maybe that's where we fall on different sides of the fence here. I think Heather Langenkamp is kind of one of the worst actresses I've ever seen. But
that's a fist fight we'll have later.
Yeah, no problem. From there, we're going to talk about Long Weekend, which is, wow. You talk about, you know, twists on traditional narratives, you know, changes in convention. And Long Weekend is a really bizarre horror film because arguably it isn't at all. It's okay. So the basic premise of Long Weekend, which is a film that Everett DeRoche wrote and Colin Eggleston directed in 1978. The basic premise is you have this married couple who are right on the verge of getting a divorce. There's something that's happened between them, events that have taken place that have really pushed their relationship to the breaking point. And they decide, well, really he decides that they're going to go camping together and try and get that spark back. Well, the problem is that they're city people. Through and through, they are absolute city slickers, and they're going out to the wilderness to go camping, and they are such douchebags. They are the absolute worst. They are yuppies to the core, and everything they do is such a slight against nature. Just like, we're going to disrespect our environment, we're gonna break these eagle eggs, we're gonna shoot at manatees, they're just the worst. And so as the story unfolds and you have this sort of, you know, this drama between a married couple, things keep happening. Really bizarre things with like animals showing up and attacking or just like behaving in ways that are counter to how that species behaves. And it just kind of keeps unfurling to the point that they try to leave and they're not able to leave. So that's kind of the setup of Long Weekend. Now, the thing about the movie is it's unclear whether there's anything otherworldly going on at all.
Well, it's interesting that the weird thing about Long Weekend is, of DeRoche's films, it's the hardest one to watch because it's such a weird movie.
It
doesn't have the kind of popcorn enjoyment that his other films have. On the other hand, it is a brilliantly constructed genre narrative that is half drama and half horror movie that everything exists in the subtext. Everything about this movie is all about the subtext. You know, this guy deciding to go out into the wilderness, it's really all about him. His manhood has been emasculated in some way. We don't know why. And he's trying to recapture it. And so he's gone and spent $2,000, which in 1978 is, you know, more akin to like $10,000, $12,000 in camping gear. And he's taking his wife out to this place that nobody's ever fucking heard of, that is an abandoned beach out in the middle of nowhere. And he has no idea what he's doing. And he just wants to go out and be manly. Yeah. And he's just doing stuff. One of my favorite moments in the movie is she wakes up at camp and he's taking an axe to a tree. And she's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm cutting down the tree. And she's like, why?
Why not?
I don't know.
He says, why not?
Yeah, why not? There's no reason for him to be doing it. He's just doing what he thinks he's supposed to be doing. And the entire film is set up this way to its beautifully ironic ending. You know, the way the ending, and I won't spoil it for anyone who wants to watch it, but the ending of this film, the various ends that each character has plays in very specifically to what character details we get about them through the movie. And it is just, it's all constructed in such a way that if it were a short story, it would be one of those really great short stories that people would pass around and be like, oh, have you read this great thing, Long Weekend? It's so weird and creepy and cool. But because it's a film and because it's so ambiguous about everything and asks you to do so much work, it's not the type of film that you expect to sit down and watch when you watch it. This is really a film for film lovers who want to sit down and watch something that is an art film disguised as genre.
Yeah, and much like Razorback, it has these sequences that feel very dreamlike that feel as if you're not really sure they're happening in reality. And that's on purpose. That's very much a function of where the characters end up, because they get pushed to a point where you can't really tell if there is something after them, if nature is conspiring against them, or if they're just completely out of their element.
Or if they're actually in some form of purgatory.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's so many different, and it's all stuff that you have to read into and kind of put together. And it's definitely a coffee discussion film. This is the kind that if you decide to sit down and watch Long Weekend, and I think you should, watch it with a couple friends with some beers or with coffee, and then sit around talking about it afterwards and share your feelings on it. Because Brian and I have never discussed it. And I think after we turn off recording here, we're probably going to sit down and share our personal theories on what this is. But it's that kind of a film. It really is the kind where you have to dissect every little thing. And well, in the first 15 minutes, the character says this, and that ties into the thing that they say, you know, an hour and 15 minutes in. And so if you put that together, this is what's happening. And, yeah. and it's a really weird kind of cool think piece like that. But it does sell itself as a horror film, and it's not really a horror film. In fact, if you break down its elements, it's a shitty drama and a shitty horror film. But put together, it's a really interesting art film.
It is both. Yeah. On top of that, it also has elements of being a cautionary tale. It has elements of delving into sexual politics, and specifically everything that was kind of at the forefront in the late 70s across the planet when it came to gender equality and the changing roles for men and women. And yeah, there's a lot going on in this film that is on its surface a nature fights back film.
And the script is so well written.
Sure it is.
Of what little dialogue is in the film overall, every single line has meaning. Mm-hmm. And everything about this film like this, you can tell this is one of those hungry young screenwriter screenplays. The I'm going to write this brilliant film, and then the brilliant film doesn't hit, and it's like, okay, I'm going to write something about a giant fucking razorback. And it really, and this coming early, very early on in his career and being one of his early recognizable films, it really does feel that way. It feels like I'm going to write my experimental film about, you know, the dissolution of a marriage and the loss of manliness and, you know, a woman's place in the current era. And it's great for all that, but it's not the type of thing that you can put in front of anybody and have them know that they're going to come out enjoying it, because they're going to be looking at you going, the fuck was that even about? I know, right? Let's talk about it. And that's Long Weekend.
Indeed. Now, so far we've looked at three films in the DeRoche canon, and if you examine these three thematically, you'll notice a commonality. And this is something that I actually thought about while revisiting them all recently. Is DeRoche is really interested in this complex insider-outsider relationship. And by that I mean, you have to remember, this is an Australian screenwriter who, you know, take the first one we talked about, Road Games, is about an American truck driver in Australia. You also have, in the second film, Razorback, an American looking for his murdered girlfriend or wife in the outback. And then even Long Weekend, which is about an Australian couple and takes place in Australia, manages to find a way to put two people from Australia into an environment that even they become outsiders because they are city people in the wilderness. And it really fascinates me what fascinated him about it. Like, I want to know what it was about the idea of sort of this paradox of being an insider outsider. And it was an interesting trend that I kept noticing in his movies and especially, In Razorback, where you have both sides of the coin. You have somebody who is thoroughly from the environment, somebody who has made their living doing exactly what it is that drives them for the rest of the film, which is hunting razorbacks. And then you have an American who has absolutely no idea what he's doing there, has, you know, no concept of the outback, has no concept of what a razorback is. And it creates this really fascinating juxtaposition that was really kind of the light bulb moment. I was like, oh, this is a common theme in DeRoche movies.
Well, all of those three films are about Australia. Like the other two we're going to talk about are both ambiguously set, as are many of his other movies. He did a few others that never quite caught take place in Australia, but most of his work is, you know, ambiguous. But those three films, Australia is almost a character. And in, you know, The Long Weekend, the antagonist is the wilderness. And in Razorback, the antagonist is the wilderness. And right. The wilderness, the outback ends up being such an, such an opponent for several of the characters in many different ways. And then in, Road Games, it's all about them traversing Australia and being, you know, these outsiders going through this relatively unfamiliar land. And yet
Stacy Keach is so entirely comfortable in his environment within the alien environment, which is to say the cab of that truck. He's a truck driver, and everything he knows is driving a truck. So even though he is in this completely foreign environment to him, it's contained within this sub-environment that is entirely comfortable to him.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's what fascinates me, is he creates like these compartmentalized type situations where it's not as simple as, you're from another place and this is a weird place to you. It's so much deeper than that, to where you could make the argument that every one of these outsiders from some aspect is in fact an insider as well.
And this is why we're talking about DeRoche. None of these films are exactly as they appear on from the box cover. Each one of them is its own unique film that is unlike in many respects any other in its genre. It's not just another genre knockoff. He was always trying to do something different with every film that he did, even when he was playing with ideas that were overdone. You know, he made two pissed off nature movies that are unlike any other pissed off nature movie that you can compare it to. Yeah, Razorback is a knockoff of Jaws, but it's got so much more going on than Jaws does. Yeah. In fact, in order to get the number of plots and subplots into Razorback from the Jaws movies, you have to take 2.5 Jaws movies and sew them together to get as much depth and character and weird things going on as you find in Razorback.
That was the closest anybody has come, and I know you didn't exactly do this, but that's the closest anybody has come to using depth and character in Jaws 3 in the same thought.
Well,
was
I
so
did
close.
Say half.
I know.
Because I was only counting Jaws
2
3.
Two and a half. I'm just saying, that's the closest anyone has ever come to actually applying character and thought to Jaws 3. And speaking of things that you don't need to apply a lot of thought to, the next film we're going to talk about is Patrick. Now, Patrick is sort of one of the standard bearers of Ozploitation. Like, it is a film that even if you're only vaguely familiar with the subgenre, you've probably heard of Patrick, because Patrick is one of the most – conceptually the most outrageous. And here again, Richard Franklin is directing. And here again, he's working in elements of Hitchcock's canon, because the backstory of the titular character – borrows elements from Norman Bates' backstory as well. Patrick is about a guy who is in a coma and, with his psychic powers, able to still kill people.
May we introduce you to Patrick. He's playing dead. Or is he?
Yeah. That is the premise of the film.
And that's what the movie is. And that's
pretty much it.
And it's the thing is Patrick is such a weird movie.
It really
is. And it's the thing is it the movie it reminds me most of is Phantasm, in that it's a movie that is so of its age and was so cutting edge and new and original at the time, but whose ideas have been lifted since in many respects, to where when you look back at it, it's not a movie that's easy to hand to young genre fans.
No, not at all.
And have them appreciate it for the power that it had when it came out. And it also has the reason why I put those two together is because they also have the very same final shot practically. They both do a last minute stinger in an era when you didn't do last minute stingers, but the stinger ultimately kind of undercuts the rest of the movie. And you walk out going, wait, what? Wait, did that just happen? And what does that mean for the rest of the movie? And I don't understand. And both of those films have that feel, and that's Patrick. Patrick is a very weird, cool concept that in both of its major iterations, in fact, I would say all three of its iterations, if we count the Italian knockoff, as we here at Junk Food Cinema often do.
As we will always do, because Patrick Vivancora, which means Patrick lives again, is one of the best instances of the Italians just not giving a shit about copyright laws.
Yeah, but none of its iterations actually ever deliver on the promise of the idea, or I feel the script.
Yeah, no, that's – yeah, it's fun to watch as sort of an oddity and sort of this weird chapter in the history of – a footnote in the history, a chapter in the history of a footnote. It's, I mean, you start, your eyes are going to go cross if you think about it too much. But yeah, like the most, I mean, the actual look of the character Patrick, I think, is what's most memorable about this film. Just him being in that bed with those big eyes and playing off a lot of the sort of like, Carrie. I guess Carrie is also a movie you could kind of closely compare this to, in terms of its gimmick. So they basically took Carrie and put Carrie in a coma. So it's Coma Carrie. It's a weird film.
It's a film that I wouldn't want to have included in the five films that I would talk about DeRoche, except that it is his most well-known film.
It really is. Yeah, absolutely. And no, I'm with you. This is probably my least favorite of his films. But again, you cannot talk about Everett DeRoche without talking about Patrick, because even people who are only cursorily aware of Ozploitation probably have heard of Patrick. And I mean, it just got remade, for crying out loud, by Mark Hartley. Yeah. So the guy who made the documentary, the definitive documentary about Ozploitation, also directed the remake of one of its standard bearer films. That's like if Ken Burns decided to become a Civil War reenactor. Like, it's such a bizarre crossover.
Well, yeah, except that Patrick is one of the few films from the Ozploitation era that you can look at and go, oh, that wasn't executed to its best potential at the time. It's prime for a remake.
Yeah.
It's got a great concept. People remember it. And it wasn't – you can't sit down and go, this is a perfectly executed film. Like, remaking Razorback would be, you know, a tougher call, you know. Or remaking Road Games. You know, it's one of those things where those are movies that delivered on their promise for the most part, that you can look at and go, that is a movie of its time that can only exist right there. But Patrick was one, it's like, oh, that idea can work now. It just wasn't done as well.
Yeah, and it's one of the instances too where, you know, when the film was released in America, it was redubbed with American actors to hide the accents, which is something that, when we talk about our last film in here in just a minute, is a situation where they were desperately trying to hide the Australian-ness of the movie. But also what I think is interesting is, you know, we can talk about Patrick being, you know, a kind of a flawed execution of an interesting concept. It does have its fun moments, but it's also the film that got Richard Franklin Psycho 2.
Yeah.
It is the film that Universal specifically screened when they were considering him for directing Psycho 2, and went, oh yeah, this is the guy. And again, owing a lot of that is owed to the fact that there are homages to Hitchcock all over this film. And
it's a very pretty film. It's a film that looks really good and has some genuinely creepy moments. It just, I think that its biggest crime is that it just hasn't aged well.
Yeah.
And that some of the things that were acceptable flaws at the time aren't considered acceptable now.
Here's a fun tidbit as well. There was a planned sequel that Everett DeRoche and Richard Franklin were going to do called Patrick 2, The Man Who Wasn't There. And it was about a religious cult finding Patrick's corpse and reviving it at least back to a comatose state. I kind of want to see that sequel.
I kind of want to see that movie too.
That really is.
Yeah, I really wish that it happened. I mean, if it had happened, we may not have gotten the other DeRoche films that we're talking about now, because it would have happened in that era. But
yeah.
But man, I kind of want to see where that goes.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable feat, if nothing else, to have a film whose supernatural villain, a human being, does not have a single line of dialogue in the movie. He doesn't say a word throughout the whole film, and yet he's a scary antagonist. So well done there, at least. So from there, the film we're going to use to kind of close out this retrospective of Everett DeRoche
is my favorite DeRoche.
Is a personal favorite of Mr. Cargill. So I'm going to let you take the reins on this. Tell us a little bit about Harlequin.
Harlequin. Okay, Harlequin is exactly the type of movie that is bold right up the middle of what I love. It is a very weird film, and is a film that would be one of our cult classics had both of the actors not pulled out at the last minute. This movie was written and set up for David Bowie and Orson Welles.
Which is – the David Bowie part especially is so evident throughout the entire movie, especially in the costuming.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I'm
no,
stepping
no, no,
on.
No, by all means – yeah. No, it is a – what it is a weird psychedelic fantasy movie. And it's about – it is – what it is it's actually a retelling of the Rasputin story with supernatural elements added in. So it's the story of this guy who is – a senator, yeah, he's a maybe. Senator. this is where it starts getting weird because it's in pure exploitation fashion. They want it to seem like it's in America, but they don't quite have American politics, and they don't. Not everyone has American accents.
Yeah,
and it doesn't look like American politics at all. But then at the same time, it doesn't look anything like Australia either.
True.
And so you have this guy who's a senator, whose son is dying of cancer, who's in a loveless marriage, and all of a sudden, this guy shows up in the son's room in the middle of the night.
Now, hold on. It's not going where you think it is.
No. And he helps cure the son. And then the son wants him to show up, so he just starts magically appearing around the place. And then the mom wants to get to know him and starts getting to know him and find out that he is this charming, wonderful man. And she starts falling in love with this weird, magical man who keeps showing up and to heal her son. And as the movie develops, you see more and more that this weird, magical man is very much there for a reason, and he has a purpose. And you start wondering if he's actually just a creepy con man, or if he's actually magical and if he actually possesses supernatural powers. And the movie plays fast and loose with that until the end. And it's this cool, weird, twisty, turny, political thriller with possibly magic. And it's really fascinating. It's really weird and off kilter. And it's just fucking cool.
Yeah. No, it is a really strange film, but one that I think benefits from its sort of non-traditional storytelling. The magic that's presented, you never really know if it's benevolent or malevolent.
Yeah.
Like, you're never really entirely sure, because the characters around the source, or the Harlequin, who is played by Robert Powell.
Supposed to be played by David Bowie. And he's playing it as David Bowie.
Yeah. He's playing it with this sort of like these glam rock flourishes that you just expect him to just break out into song about changes. And David Hemmings plays sort of the senator, the patriarch of the family. And it just kind of the family that's built around him is so dysfunctional that you're never really sure whether he's there to save the boy or to kill him. Like, his motives are never really entirely clear, but throughout it's that tension, I think, that really drives the plot of the movie.
Yeah, and it's just a cool, oddball film that keeps you off center until the end, when you can reflect on everything and everything becomes crystal clear, and then it just becomes even more awesome. This recently got showed at Butnumathon this year. It was the first time that I'd seen it, and I just fell madly in love with it. It was something that Harry had seen a trailer for and just had to see. And he didn't know if it was any good or not. Hadn't watched yet. Was just like, I'm going to take a shot with this. And it was just so my thing. And it is my favorite DeRoche movie. The script is so smart. In fact, I think the biggest problem with the movie is that the director of the film doesn't quite get some of the dialogue. And so the delivery of it, seems like they didn't understand what they were saying and seems like non sequiturs. But if you examine the writing, you see exactly what DeRoche was trying to do. Like, there's this famous moment in it where, you know, the senator and the Harlequin are having an argument at the table, and the wife just out of the blue goes, anybody up for strip poker? And everybody just the minute that line happens, just the room, you could hear a pin drop in the room as everybody's just staring at each other. And then everybody's like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
And you realize in context of the scene, it's the wife is showing that no one's paying attention to her. She's trying to say something shocking to get everybody to break everybody out of the argument, and nobody will break out of the argument because these two guys are really locked. Their horns are locked. And it seems so weird in the moment, but it's such a smart little moment that, had it been directed just right, could have been a really effective moment. And there's a few moments in the movie like that. There's one moment that I love, that's just terrible. And I don't know why they did it, but it's so laugh out loud terrible that I can't help but love it, because the movie's otherwise so good. And then all of a sudden we get a montage of photos of what is a period of time in the romance between the Harlequin and the wife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where all of a sudden it becomes
a Polaroid commercial.
It becomes a Polaroid commercial for 30 seconds. And you're just like, what the fuck is going on? Wait, this was so, this was so good. I don't know what's, and then it goes, returns to the film and you're just like, what was that? And it's almost like, hey, we shot some scenes, they didn't work, or we couldn't shoot some scenes, so we went out in the lawn and took some photos and we'll just use that.
Look, we paid for these locations. We're going to use these damn locations. They're idyllic. They are idyllic snaps and Polaroids.
And it's clear that they're all taken on the same day, but the way it's done like a transition where, like, we're supposed to believe that months have passed.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just, it's a very weird moment that I think is a flaw in the direction. Whereas I think the script for this movie is fucking genius. Like, every little nuance in here. And I could see why they'd gotten David Bowie and why they'd gotten Orson Welles for this movie, because it's that caliber of a movie. And had they done it, this would be one of those weird cult classics that people would pass around and would know about. It would be like Man from Earth and The Man Who Fell to Earth. And, you know, these weird kind of oddballs, late 70s, early 80s movies. But instead, it's not that at all. It's just a weird movie with a brilliant screenplay that I just is so exactly what I love that I can't help but love the shit out of it. Of DeRoche's films, it's the one that I own on Blu-ray.
There you go. And it's again, not an easy film to get on Blu-ray. None of these films are really easy to get in the States. I think Razorback is only available through MGM's archive. So it's like made on demand. When you order it, they print you a DVD.
Yeah, you can buy it on VOD and you can own it. You can't rent it, but you can own it. And sadly, that transfer is not great.
Not great at all.
And in fact, that's one of the sad things about many of the DeRoche films. The transfer on long weekend is equally crappy. They're both very digitized, straight ports. From whatever version they found. And it's sad because both of those films in particular are particularly beautiful. Razorback is a gorgeous film.
Yes.
In fact, there's a shot at the end when it switches aspect ratios that I almost think that most of the film as we have seen it is not in the proper aspect ratio at times. That what we think is like interesting lenses might actually just be a complete, fuck up in how they transferred it.
It's very likely. Cargill, did you know that there are 1,948 calories in a Bloomin' Onion? Because there are 1,948 calories
in a Bloomin'
Onion.
I actually did know that. It is over 3 days worth of calories. I used to work at Chili's and it was one of those things that you would learn that and learn why you're not supposed to sit down and eat a single Bloomin' Onion in one sitting, because it's 3 days of calories for a grown 200-pound man. And it's also like 4 or 5 days worth of fat.
It's insane. But a Bloomin' Onion, of course, comes from Outback Steakhouse. And the reason I bring this up is I feel like it is the perfect pairing for these films, specifically because, not just because Outback Steakhouse proclaims itself to be an Australian establishment, but more specifically, it is an establishment where they have tried to create the American version of the Australian experience, which is what so many, in fact, of these exploitation films did, is they were made in Australia, but they were made for American audiences. So they would try and a lot of times fabricate a sort of American version of Australia, which is entirely what Outback Steakhouse is, very much in the same way that the Olive Garden is sort of the Americanized Italian experience.
It's you know, Japan has this great thing where their whole point is to take all the great cultures of the world and improve upon them and make them their own. And in America, we have a storied tradition of taking all the cultures from the rest of the world and making it as shitty and disposable as possible. And that's what I think ultimately several of those places that you just mentioned fall into.
It'll make you happier than a koala up a gum tree.
Well, that's our show. Hope you enjoyed this walk down the wild, wonderful Outback Trail that is the career of Mr. Everett DeRoche. And we also hope that you will seek out some of his films, as difficult as they may be to find. But I want to remind you yet again, Junk Food Cinema is on iTunes. Please go there, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, leave a review. We would appreciate it. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. We're available on Stitcher and Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargo, where else can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, they can find me at facebook.com/massaworm or at twitter.com @massaworm.
And I am on Twitter as well, at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me over at oneofus.net, doing a lot of podcasts and writing and general things like that. If you'd like to follow them, they are at oneofusnet on the Twitter. For Cargill, this is Brian signing off with this. Frightening, fascinating, evil or good, we'll take you to the brink of reality. Good night!